Joshua, chapters 10 and 11. The seventh talk in a series on the narrative portions of Joshua was presented by David Crabtree on September 17, 2006, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to be picking up where I left off last time I taught in Joshua, Joshua chapter 10 and 11. My plan is to work through the rest of the historical narrative in Joshua. There's not much left. We'll do one or two chapters today, and then there are just two or three more chapters yet to do. The rest of it is just giving out, telling where the different tribes settled in the land. Just to get a running start to it, to what we're talking about here, if you'll recall, well, let's go back to Egypt, but I'll make it short. The Israelites came out of Egypt under the leadership of Moses, and with great signs and wonders, went through the desert, came to the southern part of the Promised Land. God said, go in. They said, they're too big. God said, then don't go in. You weren't faithful. That's bad. And they said, okay, we will go in. God said, don't go in. They did go in, and they got beat up. So then God said, okay, go back into the desert, and we'll wait until this whole generation dies off. So for 40 years, they were in the wilderness, in the desert. Then, once again, God brought them into the Promised Land. This time, they went up the east side of the Jordan, came in at Jericho. God stopped the waters of the river so that they could pass through, much like he had opened up the waters of the Red Sea when they walked across there earlier, when they were leaving Egypt. They go into the Promised Land, and they take Jericho. Jericho, they march around it for several days, and then in the seventh day, they blow the trumpets, and the walls of Jericho come down, and the Israelites go in and take the city. Then they attack the city of Ai. They had been told when they attacked Jericho that they were to take no plunder. But one of them had taken some plunder. It was irresistible. It shone. It was bright and shiny. And as a result, when they attacked Ai with a small force, they were defeated soundly. They discovered who had taken the plunder, and he was punished. He was put to death. And then they attacked Ai again and successfully defeated it. So they've taken two cities in the Promised Land in a fairly short period of time, and decisively in both cases. Then, as we talked about in chapter 9, there are some representatives of the city of Gibeon that came and talked to the Israelites and said that they had come from a long ways away, but they wanted to work out a peace treaty with the Israelites. And the Israelites made a treaty with them. And then the Israelites discovered that the Gibeonites lived close by. And the Israelites, Joshua, said, we will keep our arrangement, but you will be servants of us. You will be woodcutters and water carriers for us. And the Gibeonites said, fine. That is a suitable arrangement. We're agreeable to that. So that's the situation at the end of chapter 9. And then in chapter 10, as you will see, those events become significant. So Joshua chapter 10, verses 1 through 5. Now it came about when Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had captured Ai and had utterly destroyed it, just as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, and that the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were within their land, that he feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was mighty, was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Therefore, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent word to Hoham, king of Hebron, and to Piram, king of Jarmuth, and to Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Debir, king of Eglon, saying, "Come up to me, and help me, and let us attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the sons of Israel." So the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon gathered together and went up, they with all their armies, and camped by Gibeon and fought against it. So the king of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is only 8 miles from Gibeon. They're quite close. The king of Jerusalem becomes alarmed because the Israelites have moved in. They've taken Jericho and Ai. Neither of those were particularly powerful cities. But now they've made an alliance with Gibeon, and Gibeon is different. It's a powerful city. It's fortified. It has mighty men. It has a significant army, and it's really close to Jerusalem. So the king of Jerusalem is becoming concerned for their safety, that the Israelites are coming in and they're progressing towards the south, and that Jerusalem might be at risk. So the king of Jerusalem, calls upon some of the neighboring cities to form an alliance to go against Gibeon and to defeat it before anything more transpires. I suspect his thinking is, if we punish this city which has allied itself with Israel, we will send a message to any other cities that might do the same thing. Okay, next section, 6 through 11. Then the men of Gibeon sent word to Joshua, to the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that live in the hill country have assembled against us." So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the valiant warriors. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand before you." So Joshua came upon them suddenly by marching all night from Gilgal. And the Lord confounded them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and pursued them by way of the ascent of Beth Horon, and struck them as far as Azekah and Makkedah. And it came about, as they fled from before Israel, while they were at the descent of Beth Horon, that the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with the sword. So the people of Gibeon are being besieged by this alliance headed by the king of Jerusalem, and they send word to the Israelites, "You got to come and help us." Gibeon has been found and dug up, at least partially, and has been positively identified. It was a well-fortified city, fairly large. It had one of the best springs in Canaan. And they had built the walls. They had built a tunnel that would lead from the city down to the springs, and they had walled in the springs so that they couldn't be reached from the outside. So they could withstand the siege for a very long period of time. Why they were so concerned at this point is not clear to me, because it sounds like they should have been fairly secure, but in any case, they were worried, and they appealed to the Israelites to come. The Israelites had been camped at Gilgal, which is about I think it's about 15 miles away from Gibeon. Joshua decides we've got to go. We've got to fulfill our responsibility that we have made with the people of Gibeon. And he gets together his troops. And God speaks to him and gives him a guarantee. He says, "Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand before you." So they've been given a guarantee by God that they will be successful as they go against this alliance. Gibeon gets up, marches all night long with his soldiers. So it's a forced march. I suspect that 12 miles in the night with gear is probably quite an undertaking. And this is through the hills. And they had to go up. It was a pretty good elevation gain from Gilgal to Gibeon. So they come upon the alliance unexpectedly. That is, the alliance is not expecting them. They've marched all night. They're there facing the alliance, probably in the early morning hours. And so they strike them with the alliance probably not expecting it whatsoever. So the army of the alliance flees, and the Israelites chase them down. They chase them quite a ways. If you look at your map, they chase them, I think it's about 15 or 20 miles to the south. Is where some of these Beth Horon and Makkedah are located. While they were fleeing, a storm comes up, hailstones come down, apparently large hailstones, and more of the fleeing enemy are killed by the hailstones than were killed by the Israelites. So God comes through and helps through natural forces, helps the Israelites in their defeat of the enemy. Next section. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, "O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon in the valley of Aijalon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jashar, "And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. And there was no day like that before it or after it, when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel." Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp at Gilgal. Now these verses are apparently describing something that occurred during this day that was just described in the verses before, the day in which they routed the enemy. And on that day, at some point, Joshua is looking at the situation, and I suspect it's at that point when they have encountered the enemy and the enemy begins to flee. And Joshua sees that here is a golden opportunity to really crush the enemy, but it's going to take time. In order to thoroughly defeat them, they've got their armies out here in the field where they can't, and they're on the run. So now they're accessible. If they can just catch them and kill them, this will be relatively easy, as opposed to allowing them to go back to their fortified cities and having to go through the process of besieging these cities and conquering them that way. So Joshua sees a great opportunity, but there isn't going to be enough time. And apparently he prays to God, "Stop the sun so that we can have more time to take advantage of this opportunity and defeat them entirely." And the sun stops in the middle of the day for about a whole day, and they are able then to carry out this task of routing the enemy completely. I'll come back and talk about this more at the end. Then they returned to Gilgal after having thoroughly routed the enemy. Verse 16, in the next section. Now these five kings had fled and hidden themselves in the cave at Makkedah. And it was told Joshua, saying, "The five kings have been found hidden in the cave at Makkedah." And Joshua said, "Roll large stones against the mouth of the cave and assign men by it to guard them. But do not stay there yourselves. Pursue your enemies and attack them in the rear. Do not allow them to enter your cities, for the Lord your God has delivered them into your hand." And it came about when Joshua and the sons of Israel had finished slaying them with a very great slaughter until they were destroyed and the survivors who remained of them had entered the fortified cities, that all the people returned to the camp to Joshua at Makkedah in peace. No one uttered a word against any of the sons of Israel. Now the chronology here is a little tricky, but this also could have happened during the day of the rout. The five kings, they are fleeing, and they all flee to one single location. They go into a cave in order to hide and hopefully save their lives. Somehow the Israelites know that they've gone into this cave. And in order to complete their rout of the enemy, Joshua says, "Let's not take the time to go in and get them right now. Let's just block the door, the entrance to this cave, and we'll come back and finish them off later." And then they go off and continue to pursue the enemy. So the cave is stopped up, it's blocked, the kings are inside, and that waits until the rout is over, then they come back. And the next section describes the ensuing events. Then Joshua said, "Open the mouth of the cave and bring these five kings out to me from the cave." And they did so, and brought these five kings out to him from the cave: the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. And it came about when they brought these kings out to Joshua that Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said to the chiefs of the men of war who had gone with him, "Come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings." So they came near and put their feet on their necks. Joshua then said to them, "Do not fear or be dismayed. Be strong and courageous, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies with whom you fight." So afterward, Joshua struck them and put them to death, and he hanged them on five trees. And they hung on the trees until evening. And it came about at sunset that Joshua commanded that they took them down from the trees and threw them into the cave where they had hidden themselves, and put large stones over the mouth of the cave to this very day. Now Joshua captured Makkedah on that day and struck it and its king with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed it and every person who was in it. He left no survivor. Thus he did to the king of Makkedah just as he had done to the king of Jericho. So they open up, they come back, they open up the mouth of the cave, they take the kings out, and in each case, they have the king, these defeated kings, lie down, and the leaders of Israel put their feet on the necks of the kings. And that's a sign of complete defeat of the enemy. And Joshua encourages Israel, saying, this will be the fate of everyone who resists us taking Palestine. So they're killed, they're hung on a tree until sunset, and then they're taken down and put back in the cave that they had sought safety in. That becomes their grave. Then Joshua takes Makkedah and destroys it. Following the defeat of Makkedah, Then the Israelites decide to go on a campaign of southern Palestine. And that's what's described in the next section. I'm just going to read through it. I won't make much commentary on it. Starting in 29. Then Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Makkedah to Libna and fought against Libna. And the Lord gave it also with its king into the hands of Israel. And he struck it and every person who was in it with the edge of the sword. He left no survivor in it. Thus he did to its king, just as he had done to the king of Jericho. And Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Libna to Lachish, and they camped by it and fought against it. And the Lord gave Lachish into the hands of Israel, and he captured it on the second day, and struck it and every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, according to all that he had done to Libna. Then Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish, and Joshua defeated him and his people until he had left him no survivor. And Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Lachish to Eglon, and they camped by it and fought against it. And they captured it on that day and struck it with the edge of the sword. And he utterly destroyed that day every person who was in it, according to all that he had done to Lachish. Then Joshua and all Israel with him went up from Eglon to Hebron, and they fought against it, and they captured it, and struck it, and its king, and all its cities, and all the persons who were in it, with the edge of the sword. He left no survivor, according to all that he had done to Eglon, and he utterly destroyed it and every person who was in it. Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to Debir, and they fought against it, and he captured it, and its king, and all its cities, and they struck them with the edge of the sword, and utterly destroyed every person who was in it. He left no survivor. Just as he had done to Hebron, so he did to Debir and its king, as he had done also to Libna and its king. Thus Joshua struck all the land, the hill country and the Negev, and the lowland and the slopes and all their kings. He left no survivor, but he utterly destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. And Joshua struck them from Kadesh Barnea even as far as Gaza, and all the country of Goshen even as far as Gibeon. And Joshua captured all these kings and their lands at one time, because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. So Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp at Gilgal. If you were to chart out all of these cities, all of these are the major cities in southern Palestine. For the most part, they are to the west and somewhat to the south of Jerusalem. So they're going from one city to the next. They've dealt a severe blow to many of those biggest cities by defeating the alliance. But now they go to mop up one city after another and defeat them. Then they go back to Gilgal, and from Gilgal then they launch an expedition to the north. And that's what it describes in the next chapter. And once again, I'm going to read the whole chapter, but I'm not going to make much comment on this section. Then it came about when Jabin, the king of Hazor, heard of it, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madan, and to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Akshaph, and to the kings who were of the north in the hill country, and in the Arba, south of Chinnereth, and in the lowland and on the heights of Dor in the west, to the Canaanite on the east and on the west, and the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Jebusite in the hill country, and the Hivite at the foot of Hermon in the land of Mizpeh. And they came out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. So all of these kings, having agreed to meet, came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. So Joshua and all the people of war with them came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as Great Sidon and Misrapath-Maim and the valley of Mizpah to the east. And they struck them until no survivor was left to them. And Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. Let me stop there and just make a few comments. So now they're going north. They're going against an alliance that has formed there under the city of Hazor. Hazor is by far the biggest city in that, in the northern part of Palestine. Very well fortified. And this alliance, this northern alliance now, has gathered just to the west of the Sea of Galilee, at Merom. And God instructs Joshua to go after them. And it says, so Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. The pattern here that Joshua has is to attack by surprise. He did that against the alliance in the south, and he comes upon this alliance in the north suddenly. So as soon as they gather, Joshua's right there on them before they're really ready. They are heavily armed. They've got horses and chariots. That is cutting-edge technology at this time. And it should have been very intimidating to the Israelites. But where this northern alliance was located at the time is an area that is not very flat. It's rather hilly. And Joshua probably realized, I need to attack them while they're still in the hill area and before they come down into the plains, because in the plains, the chariots would have been of much greater use. Once they're defeated, they do as God had commanded them, that is, hamstring the horses. Once the horses have been hamstrung, they are no longer suitable for pulling the chariots. And God doesn't want them. We know from, I think it talks about this in Deuteronomy, it certainly talks about it elsewhere in the Old Testament, that the kings of Israel were not supposed to amass chariots and horses. That was wrong. God didn't want them to build a formidable military force. He wanted them to trust him as opposed to building a huge military force. And it starts out early here. He wants them to defeat this alliance of the north, who have a lot of chariots and horses, but when they do so, they aren't supposed to take advantage of that technology and make it theirs. They're to destroy that. Okay, the rest of the chapter. Then Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor and struck its king with a sword, for Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. And they struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was no one left who breathed. And he burned Hazor with fire. And Joshua captured all the cities of these kings and all their kings. And he struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed them, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. However, Israel did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds except Hazor alone, which Joshua burned. And all the spoil of these cities and the cattle, the sons of Israel took as their plunder. But they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. They left no one who breathed, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant. So Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Thus Joshua took all that land, the hill country and all the Negev, all the land of Goshen, the lowland, the Arabah, the hill country of Israel and its lowland, from Mount Halak that rises toward Seir as far as Baal God in the valley of Lebanon at the foot of Mount Hermon. And he captured all their kings and struck them down and put them to death. Joshua waged war a long time with all these kings. There was not a city which made peace with the sons of Israel except the Hivites living in Gibeon. They took them all in battle. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts to meet Israel in battle, in order that he might utterly destroy them, that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Let me stop there for just a second. So they double back, they take Hazor and destroy it completely, and they're allowed to keep the plunder in this particular instance. And then it says that they did not destroy, they did not burn the other cities that stood on mounds. Most of the cities, most of the major cities in Palestine would have been on mounds. Now they're called tells. And oftentimes they were mounds that developed over time as a city would be built and would either be destroyed by enemies or it would be destroyed by the inhabitants to carry out urban renewal. Then they'd build on top of that. So these keep getting higher and higher, which is a wonderful thing for archaeologists, because you've got these layers that can be dated to one degree or another. But these cities that are on mounds, they don't destroy them completely. And so by this means, the Israelites inherit some cities that they did not build. It says in Deuteronomy that God is going to take them into the promised land, and they will get vineyards they did not plant, cisterns they did not dig. But things are going to be there in place that they didn't have to make. They're going to be there waiting for them. And the cities was one example of how God provided for them. Okay, so Joshua then conquers the whole northern area and the southern area. And in each case, the people of Canaan did not make a peace treaty with Israel. In each case, they wanted to fight against the Israelites except for Gibeon. Why did they want to fight against the Israelites? Because God had hardened their hearts. God had led them to the place where they were going to resist Israel to the very end. And that's what happened. They ended. And that was so that God could carry out the punishment that he had said that he was going to carry out on the land of Canaan because of their wickedness. Okay, the last section. Then Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron to Debir, from Anab, and from all the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. There were no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel. Only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod some remained. So Joshua took the whole land, according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war. In the previous section, it had pointed out that the war extended for a period of time. This narrative doesn't make clear how long this took, but probably we're talking a number of years before Israel has completely defeated all of the major cities in Israel. We know from the book of Judges that there's still a lot of opposition to Israel within the land, and that's something that they fight for hundreds of years, trying to subdue that opposition. So not all the Canaanites are destroyed, but all of the major cities are conquered. In this last section, it singles out the Anakim, and this is significant. The Anakim, we know from elsewhere in Scripture, they're likened to the Rephaim and the Emim, both of which are described as races of giants. And the Anakim, apparently, are also a race of giants. These are tall people. The thing that's significant about this is, if you'll recall back to the book of Numbers, when the Israelites are getting ready to go into the land the first time, they send the scouts in. And the scouts go in, and they come back with reports that it's a great land. There's lots of grapes. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. But the people are real big. They're giants. We're like grasshoppers in their sight. So it was the giants in the land that caused them to be so fearful. And now it ends the story of the conquest of the land, pointing out that in the process, these giants are eliminated. The Anakim have been dealt with and put to death. So even that thing that was most fearful to the Israelites, God has allowed the Israelites to do away with, to overcome. Okay, so that ends then the story of the conquest of Palestine by Joshua and the Israelites. And they have done what they were sent to do, and they've taken the land that God had promised to them. Okay, there are a few comments that I'd like to make on these two chapters. The first one is, I find it interesting how Joshua and the Israelites responded to the fact that God guaranteed them success. When God sent Joshua against the alliance in the south, he guaranteed them success. One could respond to that by saying, great, then let's sleep in. Let's sleep all night. If our success is guaranteed, then we don't have to put forth great effort. But that's not what they do. In fact, they conduct a rather arduous hike, overnight hike, in order to be able to take the enemy by surprise. So what we see here is God saying, I will guarantee your success, but at the same time, Joshua wanting to do everything that makes sense, put forth every effort to make their attack successful. Those two fit together, and I find that interesting. That there's a cooperation that's being seen here, that the Israelites are seeing their job as doing the best they can to fulfill their responsibility, and they don't see God's guarantee of success as abdicating that responsibility. It's still their job to do the best they can, and that's what they do. It is interesting then that when they attack this alliance and rout them, and they're fleeing, that God sends a hailstorm that kills of the enemy by hailstorms more than the Israelites killed with the sword. So God comes in and enters into this event in a way that helps them defeat the enemy, even though the Israelites are doing their best to defeat the enemy. So it's a cooperative effort. And that's the way they're seeing it, a cooperative effort in which it is their responsibility to do the best they can to carry out this task that's been given to them. Okay, second thing of interest in this passage is the day when the sun stood still. This is a tough one. And I spent quite a bit of time roaming cyberspace on this one, and there are quite a few places that you can go. There's quite a bit that's been written about this particular event. What you see on one side is sermons devoted to this and describing this as a miraculous event. And then on the other side, you see people who are debunking the Bible using this as another example of something that is ridiculous in the Bible. But there are other kind of sidelights to that, and both sides refer to this one event. There was a fellow that was tangentially involved in the NASA space project. who apparently in the early 70s, on several occasions in public talks that he gave, talked about something that happened when they were setting up their computers to calculate stuff that NASA was going, trajectories and all that sort of thing that they were going to do with their space flights. And they, in trying to figure out where all of the bodies in space will be at any particular time, according to this man's account, they were calculating back in history where these bodies had been so they could project into the future, and discovered that their calculations were off by 24 hours, actually a little more than 24 hours. And this guy said, this proves that Joshua 10 is true, that for 24 hours the sun stood still. And then there's another passage in, I think, Isaiah, where the sun moves back several steps, the shadow moves back several steps on the staircase. And that's the other period of time that that these calculations showed to be missing. So then there are people on both sides of this that talk about this person and his comments. Apparently no one else has come along who was working on the project to say that this happened. This fellow has died, is now dead. But apparently he never retracted what he said. So both sides refer to a lot of these details in this controversy. And then this shows up on a site of urban myths as one of their examples of an urban myth, that there's no evidence that the NASA computers ever did this, nor, it was argued, is that even possible to project back where stars were for sure and find such a gap. The other kind of thread that developed on this particular topic surrounds a kind of renegade scholar. His name is Emmanuel Velikovsky, born in Russia in the late 1800s. He emigrated to Austria, I believe, first, lived there a period of time, then just before World War, just before 1939, he left Austria, went to England, and then eventually made his way to the United States. A very learned man in a wide variety of fields. And he has always been controversial. And he wrote a series of books in the 1950s. Worlds in Collision was one of them. I think World in Chaos is another one. All of them are dealing with dating of events in history. And what's unique about his approach is he accepts historical traditions. He puts significant weight on historical traditions, as opposed to the tendency of modern science to dismiss all oral traditions as being worthless. Well, Velikovsky began to look at the traditions of other countries and discovered that there is a pattern, and that is that there are traditions all over the world that talk about a period of time, a day or a night that was lengthened. There's an Indian, a legend that the Indians kept in Mexico, that talks about a time when the sun started to rise and it stuck there. There is an oral tradition in China of a night that went on too long. And Velikovsky looks at those and he says, I'm not going to dismiss that kind of evidence. I take that seriously. So he starts to put that all together and decides that this account in Joshua is retaining the memory of something that actually did happen. That there must have been a day in which the sun got stuck. And by the location of these stories and what they say, it seems to have gotten stuck in the Middle East. And he goes on to build a rather fabulous theory that would account for this. He argues that Venus was not a planet in historical times and became a planet in historical times, that it was floating through the solar system and came close enough to the Earth to have a significant effect on it. And it did that twice. It went past the Earth twice, once at the time of the Exodus, and that accounts for certain things that happened in the Exodus. The other time now in Joshua, that accounts for the Earth, the rotation of the Earth getting messed up. And then it landed in where it is in the solar system and got caught there and has been there ever since. There are others who look at Velikovsky's theory and say, absolutely preposterous. I mean, that's absurd. If we just take seriously that the Earth stopped spinning, if you think about all of the effects that would result from that, the tides, I mean, if you stop the Earth, there's still momentum. They say that there are going to be huge tides that are going to sweep over a lot of land. There are going to be earthquakes. There are all kinds of things that are argued they're saying it's just absolutely impossible that the Earth would stop spinning for that period of time. Okay. So that's internet stuff. If, according to Dalich, a commentator on the Old Testament, he argues that he thinks that the text does not even demand that the Earth stop spinning. That what happened here is Joshua asked for more time to be given to the Israelites in order to carry out the task that God had given them. And what God did was give them the ability to carry that task out much faster than could have been expected. So subjectively, the day was extended, and they were able to get 2 days' work done in 1 day. Is that possible? I think it's possible. My only concern with that is verse 14. Verse 14 says, "And there was no day like that before it or after it, when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel." Does that verse describe a subjective experience? Would that be adequate? Would a subjective experience where it seemed like the day just went on and on, they got a lot done, would that be adequate to call it a day that there was no day like it before it or after it? I don't know. Possibly. I'm inclined to think that the day actually was longer. And that what is being claimed here and what's really significant about this day is Joshua asked a petitionary prayer. Joshua asked for something specific. And God chose to grant that request. And he granted that request even though it altered the the timeless order of the solar system, even though it changed the way that the Earth was spinning. I think that's what's described. Now, how do I account for the physics problems? I don't know. Are the physics more complicated than we think they are? Are there confluences of effects that can bring about things that we would otherwise say are impossible? I think that's quite likely. I mean, we don't know everything. We aren't as smart, I think, even as smart as we think we are. Or it could have been truly a supernatural event. I mean, one that superseded the laws of physics. I'm reluctant to go that direction, but I think that it's possible that God did that. So I don't know. I think it's a real problem. I don't know how to explain it, but I think that the text is better understood as indicating that the sun actually did stand still. And that is to say, the earth actually did either stop spinning or slow down spinning. Okay. Then one last comment. And this is really kind of tangential to the passage, but I was struck by the name of the king of Jerusalem that headed up the alliance of the south that fought against the Israelites. In chapter 10, verse 1, it's Adonizedek. Adonizedek means my Lord is righteous. He's the king of Jerusalem. We know that during the time of Abraham, the king of Jerusalem was Melchizedek, which means king of righteousness. Some have argued that those are equivalent, and that may have been the title of whoever was king in Jerusalem. And I'm suspicious that might be the case, that there does seem to have been a tendency for the names of the kings to be passed down. The king of a certain locale, they have a certain name given to them, and their successor gets that same name. Pharaoh is kind of an example of that. That Pharaoh becomes the king of Egypt, and every king becomes known as Pharaoh. In any case, Adonizedek, the king of righteousness, with a name like that, he should be a good guy. I mean, when you first look at it, you think, that's got to be a good guy. But what struck me when I was thinking about it is, things aren't always what they seem. That which strikes you as being, as sounding good and right, is not necessarily good and right. I'm going to draw in a number of thoughts here, and I hope I don't lose you completely as I try to pull several of my thoughts together. But I have been intrigued by the events in the Middle East in the over the summer in particular. I read a book on the history of the Middle East, and then just recently started reading the Quran. And I'm hoping to read all the way through it. School year's about to begin, so I probably won't make it, but I've started into it, and I find it very, very interesting. There is much in the Quran that sounds very much like the Old Testament. I mean, Muhammad obviously had read the Old Testament, because there's a lot of the language is worked in there. A lot of the themes are built into the Quran. But the question that's really intriguing to me is the spirit of what's there the same? A lot of the same phrases, a lot of the same words, but is the spirit the same? Is it talking about the same God? And I think the answer is ultimately no, it's not talking about the same God. It seems to me that we are entering into confusing times. I don't know how close we are to the end. But as we get towards the end, I think the Bible makes it clear that things will become confusing because Jesus raises the question of whether there will be faith on earth when he returns. And so it becomes increasingly important for us to be able to figure out what is true and what is counterfeit. Not just going by phrases, but by going by substance. And a couple of years ago, it occurred to me that Jesus Christ was the translation of God into flesh. That God decided that he would become one of us and live among us. He would become a man. But in becoming a man, that's like translating something. In becoming a man, something was going to get lost. And something was lost. So the question is, what if Jesus is the essence then of what God wanted us to see as him, if Jesus is God's self-portrait on the canvas of human flesh, what did he retain? What was most important for him to retain? And it wasn't his power. It wasn't his intelligence even. It was his moral goodness. That's what is essentially God. I mean, that's what is most near and dear to him, is his moral character. And I find it intriguing that when Jesus came, that there were people who knew the Bible well, people who studied the Bible frequently, the Pharisees, who when Jesus came, they didn't recognize him. And that's because they hadn't paid attention to and devoted a lot of attention and energy to figuring out what kind of God is this? How would I recognize him if he came and stood in front of me? And I think it's the case that if it is as if they focused on appearance. They focused on rather superficial things rather than on that which is essentially God, which is his character. And I think for us in our time, it's becoming increasingly important if we are entering into the end times, but it's important even if we aren't entering into the end times, to carry out that project of trying to clarify who is this God of the Bible. And the question of who is this God of the Bible is a question of who is this God, not just of the New Testament, but of the Old Testament as well. Whoever God is, he's the kind of God that would pick Abraham, out of whom he would bring his own special people. And he's the kind of God that would promise Abraham an heir that wouldn't be delivered until Abraham was an old man and thought he couldn't have a child. And he's the kind of God that would ask Abraham then to put that child to death. And he's the kind of God that would lead Abraham's descendants into Egypt and into slavery for several hundred years. And the kind of God that would bring them out of Egypt with signs and wonders. And we can go on and on, but it's whatever we read of God in the Old Testament, that's the same God. And our image of God has to account for all of that. And I would say that even includes the harem that is required by the Israelites when they go into Palestine, that they are supposed to kill all of their enemies in Canaan, men, women, and children, that somehow our picture of God has to fit that in, and it all has to be integrated together. And it's the same God who answered Joshua's request that the day be lengthened so that they could defeat their enemies. So I offer that as kind of an apologia for doing the Old Testament. I think it's really critical that we look at the Bible as a whole and use all of the clues that we've got to figure out who is this God that we serve. And it's going to be increasingly critical that we know, be able to distinguish the true God from that which is not the God of the Bible. Okay. Questions, comments?
I was just thinking before you, as you were saying that before, because I've heard people or read on the internet lately, as when people think about God, especially now, it seems like, to even begin to try to comprehend the bloodshed that went on when he required of Israel to kill everyone, that does make a lot of people just dismiss God if they do think about the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And it seems like real intelligent people will do that. I'm not going to go to the New Testament if he's that kind of God. And for myself, I've thought a lot about that. It seems to have something to do with God understanding totally that death is not the worst thing. Mm-hmm. And anyway, but I wondered if you'd have more to say about that, how we look at that when he did require that mm-hmm. budget.
Well, God had decided that he was going to punish the Canaanites for their wickedness. He could have done it by some other means. He did it by other means elsewhere in the Bible, for instance, Sodom and Gomorrah. That was done by the fire and brimstone that was sent down from heaven, rather than having Abraham and an army go and rout them. So God could have done it by another means, but he chose to do it through the people of Israel. And I don't know that we should see it as a precedence that was a unique event, and it was conducted by God's people, the Israelites. And I think it was conducted in a way that was respectful of the people of Palestine. Now that gets into a much longer discussion. And maybe I should raise it sometime, and I might in future weeks I might raise that. But I've been thinking about comparing what God asked the Israelites to do, the carrying out the harem, comparing that with jihad. Because the Islamic fundamentalists are describing what they are doing, the jihad, in very similar terms to what the Israelites carried out in Palestine. And I think that's very interesting. But I think there are some significant differences behind it. And I won't explore that now, but that's something that we might explore in a few weeks.
Thank you very much. That was really good, David. I guess I have a comment about the long day, and okay. You and I have had discussions about mm-hmm. stuff like this before. I think mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm much less resistant to take miracles in the Bible as pretty straightforward events.
To clarify, you mean not consistent with the laws of physics and chemistry?
Sure, sure. I was trying to think of how I could bring my thoughts together on that in a way that would be helpful. This is just one facet. There's lots that could be said. We live every day with patterns, with things happening according to an order. Okay, the laws of physics, we're familiar with those. I mean, and we made up the laws of physics, I think, to define the patterns that we see. Okay, and for the most part in our lives, things work pretty consistently. I mean, with remarkable consistency, I think, and regularity. And so, and we get used to that, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, we rely on the laws of physics in order to move through life and do whatever we do. So it makes sense to me that God would have created reality the way that he did. It also makes sense to me that it's not a problem in any sense to me that God is certainly big enough and powerful enough and wise enough to interrupt those laws and those patterns any way and any time that he sees fit to accomplish his purposes. And so, and I too have thought about the problems from the perspective of the laws of physics with the earth stopping to its spin for any period of time. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't matter how long. Mm-hmm. But if you think about God's relationship to his creation in maybe a little different way than our normal everyday way of thinking of that relationship, and if you're willing to step outside your world of patterns and your world of consistency and realize that God is the one that is causing every, you know, atomic particle to spin around every single nucleus at this very moment. I mean, it's no big deal for him to interrupt those laws and to cause every single bit of momentum that was built up by the spinning of the earth to stop for whatever period of time. So I guess it's certainly an incredible event. I mean, there's no doubt that it's a marvelous event. It should set our heads spinning, you know. But the fact of its miraculousness, I guess, doesn't give me a problem.
Right. But by the miraculous
in every sense. In every sense. Yeah. I mean,
and I think that's possible. But the question is, the way I think about it, God is a God of order. So those patterns are things that he established, and it's those patterns that make it possible for us to know and make sense of it. So is he going to violate that patternedness? I'm inclined to think that he would not violate that patternedness, but that doesn't mean that those patterns aren't really complicated. So it's that question, it seems to me, is it a really complicated patternedness that makes possible the earth to stop for a number of hours? Or did God actually supersede those patterns completely? I don't know.
Well, and I think we agree that the purpose of miracles is to attest to God and to authenticate his power and his divine nature and so forth. So,
yep, absolutely.
Have you considered the possibility of a sun lamp ophany?
No.
Seems to me the bigger, more basic question here is navigating this minefield of historical narrative. Because sometimes it says God said and they did. And then other times it says they did this. So when it says, when Joshua says, you know, run him in the cave, bury it, just shut it off, and we'll get to him later. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't say God told them to do that.
Right.
It just says they did it.
Right.
And sometimes I wonder if the narrator isn't saying, they did this. And that's all he's saying. They did this. This is just between Monday and Friday, I'm filling in some of the events. But something happened on Sunday where God told them to do a particular thing, and then they did. And so what I hear a lot of teachers not addressing is that issue. You know, David had concubines and wives. Well, God never told him to have concubines and wives, and yet they'll use that to justify having concubines and wives, mm-hmm. because, you know, the guys in the Old Testament did it. So kind of handle, if you can, that tension between understanding narrative for narrative's sake and narrative for authentication and narrative of the command and the response by the people. It seems to be important.
Well, let me talk a little bit, and you can tell me whether I answer your question or not. You're right that there are times when the text tells us that someone was supposed to do something. There are other times when the text does not tell us whether someone was supposed to do something. So we don't know whether they were acting in obedience to God or not. My operating hypothesis is that wherever it's important for the author's purposes, that we will be able to determine whether they were acting in obedience to God or not. And I think in most cases, it is important to the author's purposes. If we take the example of this event where they put the kings in the cave, I read that what Joshua did was consistent with what God had told them to do. And the reason I read it that way is because we get at least two places where it says explicitly that all that Joshua did was in conformity with what God had asked them to do. So I take that to be an endorsement of all that's described of Joshua doing in this conquest. So here it seems to me it's relatively easy that Joshua did that right. Now, do you want to follow up on that?
Abraham pretended his wife was his sister. Worked out great for him. But it doesn't say God told him to do that.
Right.
So when I face this dilemma,
right.
Do I pretend my sister's my wife in order to pull the wool over someone's eyes? Right. That kind of reasoning, to me, is what I hear a lot of. And I say you're confusing narrative with command. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
The difference?
And that's harder. That particular passage, I think, is harder. But I think with enough sensitivity to the text, in that particular case, that one should be able to determine whether what Abraham did there was consistent with what God had asked him to do or not, whether it was disobedient. In most of those cases, I think that the narrator wants you to know whether they were being obedient or disobedient. Because that's a lot of what the narrator is talking about, is the relationship between the human beings that he's focusing on and God. And whether one is acting faithfully or rebelliously, that's an important part of what the narrator is doing. But that's a tough issue. There are a lot of cases where it's really hard to tell, it seems to me, whether someone is acting obediently towards God or not from the text.
But you would agree, would you not, that there can be a tendency to look at something like the Old Testament and want to know whether one is acting obediently or not in order to use the Old Testament, the behaviors of Old Testament believers or characters as some kind of template for our lives. And you would agree, wouldn't you, that that's not the right way to approach the narrative?
Oh, I mean, absolutely.
This is a messy world that God is working in the Old Testament, just as it is today. And there's a lot of unrighteousness and a lot of brokenness and a lot of evil that is not ideal human behavior, but it's the context in which God has come to reveal himself.
And it's what he's doing is very complex. It's multifaceted. And you have to be able to sort out what is he doing in this passage in the Old Testament? What is God doing with this person at this time, et cetera, et cetera? That gets very complex. Yep. Okay, thanks.